British Antarctic Survey Archives, Oral History Recording Number 3, Gwion Davis. A recording of Mr. Davis, a member of the Operation Tabarin Expedition, 1943-1946, in conversation with Miss Joanna Ray, Assistant Archivist of the British Antarctic Survey. Date, the 19th of September, 1986. Location, Mr. Davis's home near Conwy, North Wales. Could you give me an outline of your career before joining Operation Tabarin?
Well, I was born in Moston, New Flintshire in 1917, and I lived in Denby, North Wales, from up to 1935, except when I went to school in Quaker School in York. And then after leaving school, I had a bit of time to spare between school and university, so I spent 3 months in Rothamsted Experimental Station as a kind of a student assistant, and then went to Denmark to work in a farm for 3 months, and then I got a job on a coaster, a kind of auxiliary sailing coaster for a month, and then as a deckhand. And then I went on to college in Cambridge. My parents had moved to Cambridge because my sister worked there, the low temperature research station. And it was cheaper for me to go to college living at home than it would have been living in.
Yeah.
My father had retired a year or so earlier. And so I read natural sciences and took the TRIPOS there from 1936 to 39. Now, during the vacations, and this is partly relevant to the expedition, after spending another 6 weeks in Denmark on farm work and again as deckhand and sailing coasters, I served as signed on as ordnance seaman cook in a topsail schooner called the Mary Miller. She was one of the last fully sailing vessels under the British flag. She and the Kate, who was a two-masted topsail schooner. In fact, she was manned by a Cornishman, a captain. The master, he was a Cornishman, and the mate and the two ABs were Humber pilot apprentices who were doing their time in square rig for their training. So this counted as square rig time for them.
Mm.
So I was only 3 months in her during the summer. And then I went back to college after that. But when the war broke out, I had another year of studies to do and part two of my zoology course. But I was called up, like everybody else, for national service. And I put in to join the Navy, and when I did so, I was told to wait until I was called up. Not long after, I was invited by the head of the low temperature station, that was Dr. Kidd, to go out in a whaler as assistant to work on some experiments in preservation of whale meat, because Dr. Kidd, who was the head of the station, he and others foresaw the need for food after the war, or possibly during the war. So they thought of using whale meat for this purpose. Now, the man in charge of this program turned out to be James Marr, and he was, of course, the famous Scout Marr, who went south of Shackleton in the quest. And so I was to help him in this experimental work. He was signed on as whaling inspector, and I was signed on as labourer. So we sailed in this whaler, the Terry Beacon, sailed from Scotland in 1939 and got down to the Antarctic and spent the 3 months of the whaling season preserving and freezing and drying and canning whale meat and playing around with it. And then when we got back about 7 months later to Cambridge, we were asked to stay on to deal with the samples. And about that time, it was Dunkirk, I suppose, at about that time. And then after a little while, Mar, he volunteered and went to the Navy, and he joined the Navy, and that's the last I saw him for some time. And then later on, I was sent back on another whaler, just in case some more experimental work was needed, with which I could give a hand, but that came to nothing. And so I worked along with the crowd then, in the whaler, as labourer.
Could you tell me something about that kind of life?
The whaling?
Yes.
Well, yes. Well, for a start, in the second ship, the crew was almost mostly Norwegian, and the British crew were almost entirely Welshmen. So the two languages you heard aboard ship all the time were Welsh and Norwegian.
Mm.
Very little English. The mate was an Englishman. And... but otherwise, there's very little English spoken. And I got back most of the Welsh, all the Welsh I'd forgotten, almost forgotten it, you see, living in England for so long. And I learned a lot more too, besides. And, it was a great, great crowd to be along with. And...
not a sailing ship?
No, she had a whaling factory.
Mm.
Oh no, a big factory ship.
Mm.
Oh no, the fleet of catchers, you know, these things with the slipway up the stern.
Mm.
Oh no, there's a big crowd, she was a big ship, I don't know, 20, 30,000 tons or something like that.
Mm.
And I could say a lot about, you know, the life aboard, but perhaps there isn't time for it now.
Mm.
You know, about the singing that used to go on while we were cleaning the tanks and all that sort of thing. It was great singing.
Mm.
Never forget it. There we are. So, now, that was, after the whaling trip, I just went on to join other ships, deep sea, other merchant ships, because we were automatically then, you see, in the merchant navy.
Hmm.
So we had to stay there. In fact, they had to send fellows from the navy to man our ships at times because of the shortage.
Hmm.
And so I went and did a couple of trips to India and the United States. And then I went to the coast, a ship called the Dorian Rose. And this is 1943. And then, for some reason or other, I began to think about what I'd do after the war if I came through it. And I fancied going as... joining one of these discovery ships as AB, you see. So by that time I was AB. I'd done my time.
Mm.
And so I thought, yeah, I said, I wonder what's happened to Mar, if he's still alive. And he'd know, you see. So I wrote off a letter to Mar, I don't know what address, Discovery Committee, I suppose, when I was in Liverpool. And forgot all about it, asking him, you know, what he thought would be happening after the war, you see, in that line of work. Anyway, when we got down to Cardiff and got the ship ready for the dockers, and the mate called me off, he said, Taff, he said, there's a telegram for you from London. It's top secret, he said, and you've got to leave the ship and you've got to sign off the Merchant Navy and go to London. Oh, I said, where's it come from? I said, it's signed by a fellow called Mar. Oh, crikey. I said, well, that's okay for me, I said. So, anyway, I told him I don't want to leave the ship. I said, I'm quite happy here. And, you know, it was a good crowd, you see. Anyway, I said, well, orders is orders, so I have to go. So, there we are. Off I went to London. And when I got there, I went to the colonial office, and Mar was there, and he told me why he wanted, he was wanting an extra hand to join an expedition. And he asked me if I was willing to go. I said, it's okay with me. I said, thank you very much. Because I had great regard for Mar, you see, having served with him in the whaler.
Mm.
And so that's how I came to join the expedition. Aye.
And what did you do after the expedition?
Well, after we came back in 1946, after a few months ashore, I went back to sea then, mm-hmm. in a coaster, and I didn't know anything else to do really. It's the only work I knew. And anyway, actually, I found the work wasn't hard enough, and it was too easy a job really. It was not demanding enough after the expedition, you see. And so I went to Sweden then to work on a farm. I was there for a year and met the members of the Northern Shoals expedition, and Gunnar Andersen and I can't remember the names now, but there were two or three of them. And I showed them photographs which had been taken of the relics that were found in their old hut in Hope Bay. And they were thrilled to bits, you know. And they had me out, invited me out very kindly to a dinner. And three or four of them were still surviving. And they did me proud, really. And I was very grateful to them. And Gunnar Andersen gave me copies of his book, Men in Kring Sydpolen, Men Around the South Pole, in Swedish, which described that expedition. And he thought perhaps I might be able to translate it, because I knew Swedish, and I used to do some translation work. But I'm afraid that never came to anything. So after that, anyway, that was after coming back from Sweden, I went and did a course in agricultural science in Bangor, because I had a year owing to me, as it were, from my university course. And after doing agriculture, I ended up in fisheries. You couldn't get any more different, could you? Anyway, that was in Aberdeen, and there's a good deal of sea time there on the herring boats. And after that, I was transferred to the Fisheries Experiment Station in Conway, where I spent the last 20 years or so of my life there working on mussel farming problems. Because being in the Antarctic, really, it made me very concerned about food supplies. Because if you're always hungry when you're out sledging, it made you realise, oh, geoch, there must be a lot of people in the world who are always hungry, and they never can come back and have a good feed in the base hut like we could after the end of it. And I thought, and I'd seen, of course, this terrible hunger in India, and it made me think a lot about the need for food, and how on earth the world is going to keep itself supplied with food. Well, mussels may seem a funny thing to work on with this in mind, but actually they're potentially the most productive fish you could farm in the sea. Mm. I mean, comparable in potential with the 5 million catches of anchoveta that used to be made off the Peruvian coast, or even the 50 million tons of krill that they reckon to be able to harvest. That's a kind of thing. Mm. Now, is this something, talking about krill, I don't know if I'm going off the tangent or not, but I'd like to mention this. While we were in Port La Croix, I was working with Mar a lot in the over the stores, you know, doing the stores. And I remember his saying one day to me, he said, you know what they should do, he said, instead of catching whales, they should catch the krill they feed on. Instead, there's a lot more of it, and turn that into food. And I thought, well, that sounds a good idea. And during my agricultural course in Bangor, I got some krill from Mar, from the Discovery collection, and I made a biochemical analysis of them, protein, fat, carbohydrate, and all that sort of thing, and they turned out to be very nutritious. Mm. And then so I thought I'd follow this up and get some fresh specimens to work on them. But I was on the point, you know, trying to negotiate a trip on a whaler to do this, but for one reason or another, it fell through completely, so that never came to anything. Anyway, the point is that nowadays, and sometime afterwards, krill catching is the greatest, all the rage by the Japanese and Russians and other people. And I often think of what Ma said at the time. He was very far-seeing, and he'd got something, really.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Aye, it's only a pity he couldn't follow it up. Yeah. In fact, I often think that if this country should ever go in for it, they ought to call the ship the James Maher.
Mm.
You know, it'd be very fitting after all the work he did on krill.
Mm.
Aye, indeed.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Aye.
Could you tell me, in fact, about Maher's duties when he was organising the Operation Tavlin expedition, as far as you knew then?
His duties?
Yes, in the 3 months before he left.
All I know is that he was in Colombo in the Navy in Colombo, and he got some telegram or message from the government to come back and organise an Antarctic expedition for that year. I suppose I think that the reasons for this have been given by Sir Vivian Fuchs in his book of Ice and Men, you know, the political reasons. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Churchill's outfit saw that this was a very urgent thing that had to be mounted there and then. And this was in the summer in 1943. So he got back to his country and he had 3 months to gather a crowd of chaps together and all the gear they needed and all that sort of thing, ready for the autumn. Well, actually, what happened was this, that perhaps I shouldn't repeat what may have been repeated in Fuchs's expedition book, I should say, but you know that the original idea was to send just a party of soldiers down there, a sergeant and corporals, just to sit on somewhere in the Antarctic to occupy the place, and that was that. Well, when the Discovery Committee were called into this, they insisted that some decent scientific work should be done, make the most of the chance, you see. So, this is what Ma really tried to do. And to cut the long story short, he managed to find the right sort of scientists and the scientific gear and everything, apart from the hut and the supplies, down to the last sail needle, practically, almost single-handed.
Mm.
It's only looking back on it I realised what a fantastic job he did. It had driven me round the bend, I could never have done it anyway. It's a terrific, the job he did.
Yeah.
Because, mind you, he'd had some experience in fitting out an expedition when he was a youngster, when he went north to the Arctic in the brigantine, the Lady of Avenel. I can't remember the name of the expedition now. But his job was to fit out the expedition, so he did know something about it.
Yeah. That must have been very helpful, in fact.
Well, I'm sure it was. Mm. And it was amazing. We never wanted for anything down there. We had everything we needed. And this is not only was it such a job to think it up in such a short time, but it was wartime and you couldn't get hold of stuff.
Mm.
And despite that, he got the things together. And
were the members of the expedition available to help?
Well, no, they were all over the shop. Mm. Chippy Ashton, I don't really know where he was at the time. Actually, a lot of this is probably given in our little newsletter we had down at the bases, the Hope Bay Howler and the Port Lacroix Prattler, which Lamb and others used to bring out, you know.
Mm.
And one of the things was a series on how I came to be in the Antarctic or something like that, you see. But anyway, Chippy was in the merchant service and Jock was in the R&R. He was in a naval vessel, supply ship, a tanker supplying the fleet tanker. And I really just don't know how he got hold of all the people together.
So you only actually came together at the last minute, as it were?
Well, I think he got... I came personally. I was very much of a Johnny-come-lately. I just joined at the last minute. Mm. He was just short of a handyman. Mm. Somebody to deal with the stores. But, so I never really found out in great detail how the others came to be, how he got hold of the others. I mean, there were people, there was a Canadian, there was Andy Taylor, Captain Taylor, from the Royal Canadian Engineers, and there was Norman Lather from the New Zealand Air Force, and, you know, there were people from all over the shop. So I think he did a miraculous job of work.
In such a short time as well.
In such a short time, okay. Yes,
and
exactly.
They had to find a ship as well, didn't they?
Yeah, and it had to be kept top secret. I mean, this is the main thing. Nobody was to know because it was political, you see, in wartime. And then he went to, he got the ship, the vessel Kari, she was a sealer, and he went to Iceland to fetch her. Actually, he'd been in Iceland, based in Iceland for the Navy, during the early part of the war. So perhaps he saw her there. And she was loaded up, she was brought down to this country. She was a kind of a catch rigged vessel. I don't think she had any square yards in the main mast. I think she was catch rigged. And with an auxiliary steam engine, about 100 foot long, so I believe not unlike the Quest. And she was brought down and loaded up. And when we set off from the Royal Albert Dock, there was nobody to wave us off, as it were, not like with the usual sort of expeditions. And we all just sort of crept out in dead secrecy. And Mar was saying, he said, turn around to Fram, I think he said, and he said, never in the history of polar exploration has an expedition left with such little fuss. And anyway, there was more fuss than we realised, because what with a big load in her, and she must have been an old ship, she started to make water. And the engine got... was breaking down all the time, you see, at engine trouble, and we had to put into one port after another down the Channel coast. Now, I think most people know about the vessel carrier or the Bransfield, HMS Bransfield, as she was known at the time. She was flying the White Ensign. Anyway, she was making so much water, and, you know, by the time we got to Falmouth, that it decided to abandon her. Because, I mean, she got a long trip to make down the South Atlantic and the Roaring Forties. The idea was, you see, that we should take her down to an Antarctic base and let her freeze in, you see, and use her as a kind of a floating base or a frozen-in base like the Fram. And to, to take our time about setting up a hut and getting our gear ashore. But that wasn't to be. Anyway, when we got to Falmouth, we then had to transship all the gear to a troop ship. She was a Highland Monarch, and she was an Avonmouth. And we had a train journey from Falmouth. The whole party went by train from Jersey. Special train from Falmouth to Avonmouth, and you better ask Doc and Fram about that, because it was quite a pantomime, this train journey. It took about, I don't know, 24 hours as far as I remember, just across Devon, and we were stuck in the sidings and so on, and brewing up tea in the signal box. And
while you were waiting to
we were being shunted around. So that was quite a story in itself. I can't remember the details now, but I think Fram and Doc back can tell you more about that.
Right.
Yeah, it was quite a comical thing.
Yes.
Anyway, when we got to Falmouth, we went and bought the Highland Monarch, and she was taking troops out of Gibraltar and taking some of the Gibraltar fellows. Doc was back there too. And uh, um, when we got to the Gibraltar, I think, I can't quite remember the details, but I think the Gibraltar fellows then were sent with us down to the Falklands to relieve the garrison there. And we went down to Montevideo then.
Yeah.
And we transshipped there to the Fitzroy. You know, it's a funny thing, my mind's a bit woolly about these things now, you know. But I think that's what we did.
Yes.
Aye.
You spent your first year at Base A, Port Lockroy. What were your initial duties while the base was being established?
Well, you mean while we were landing the stores?
Yes.
Oh, well, just working along with the rest of the crowd, you see.
Well, everybody just
humping
mucked
the gear ashore. And the Falkland Islanders, the crew of the Fitzroy, they were marvellous chaps, very, very... They were used to this sort of thing. They used to lash two barges together and make a kind of raft, which they towed ashore with a motorboat. Because they were used to doing this with loading wool, you see, and out of the way places in Falkland. So just, they knew the work well. And they were most efficient. And did a marvellous job there, the crew of the Fitzroy. Anyway, they landed us and dumped us and our gear ashore and coal for 2 years and food for 2 years and everything from a kitchen stove to a sail needle, as it were, you know, including the hut and everything like that, all the timbers. And it was just a matter of shifting them up onto the top of Goodyear Islet, where we were building the hut, which Chippy was in charge of that, of course. And once the stuff was ashore, it was covered with tarpaulins as best we could and stored away. And then we turned to getting on with the hut to get a roof over our heads.
And so he directed operations, did he?
Well, Mar, of course, he was in charge, and he was the boss. We called him the boss, you see. And he organised all that sort of thing. But Chippy, he was the one really who was in charge of actually putting up the hut. Because he knew most about the job, being a specialist in that line, of course.
What were your responsibilities once everything settled down?
Oh, well, once we got settled down, well, my main responsibilities was with the gear, really, looking after that and seeing that that was okay. I was signed on, actually, as a stores officer, but, you know, it sounds a bit pompous, really, in that kind of setup. And I was really a handyman. And the others were specialists in their own field, in weather and geology and botanists and so on. And so it was only natural for me be a handyman, because I mean, having been to sea came naturally. So there we are.
What did that involve? I expect there were quite a number of problems.
Well, yes, I worked a lot with Mar. Mar was very conscious of the need to look after our stores properly. But, I remember one of the things that we spent a lot of time doing early on was scratching on the tins of food and everything else, the labels, or labelling them according to some code, because he foresaw that the paper labels could easily drop off, you see, with damp in the summer and rust and so on, and we wouldn't know what was inside. So that was one of the things we had to do. And while I was working with him day after day, work scratching these numbers and letters on these tins, etching them on, you know, I used to talk a lot about various things, and I got to know him quite well. But apart from that, I suppose my other duties were, well, anything to do with making gear for sledging and stuff like that, you know, anything with palm and needle work or rope work and so on, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Sailorising work, as you might say. And I was a coal man as well. And the first year, when we were in Port Lockroy, we got the coal in a big heap. They were in bags of about 1¾ hundred weights, about 14 stone, I suppose. And we put these in a big big pile. And then, of course, as soon as the stuff was ashore, it was all hands to building the hut. Well, while we were building the hut, came on the snow. You know, as you'd expect. And that didn't matter. The coal wouldn't take hurt from that. But what happened was that the whole of the coal heap, we got frozen in a solid mass. So whenever we wanted coal after that, we had to mine it with a crowbar. And it was quite a job getting every sack out, you see.
Right.
So that was one of my little jobs.
Mm. You had to do that, did you?
As the expedition miner, yeah.
Oh, dear.
Anyway, I was pleased to do that because it gave you a job, didn't it?
Mm.
Yeah, everybody had his own job, you see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How were the stores kept? Did you keep them by contents or...
Well, Tom Berry, he was chief steward, and he knew all about that sort of thing, and he used to say what he wanted, and he used to ask me to go and get a case of this or a case of that, and I can't really remember now. I think probably Mar used to do the bookkeeping, or Tom Berry may have done it. I can't remember. All I did was to fetch what he wanted and bring it into the hut, you see.
And was that all kept in the missing hut,
the stores, yes. Yeah. And these missing huts were ex-army huts from the Falklands. And they were taken adrift in the Falklands and stored away to taken down to be able to store them aboard ship, you see. Well, when we put them up again, of course, they were a bit worse for wear. And I remember one time we put up the frame and they got blown flat and that sheared a lot of bolts and that didn't help. So they were a bit ropey, you see, when we were put up. Anyway, they held the stores all right against the worst of the weather. And I noticed after we'd got the stores inside them, they were filling up with snow. Well, the door was quite shut and the windows were... You know, they were all in sound. I couldn't make out. Where did it come? You know, big drift, you see, burying a lot of cases, big as a double sofa, really, in some of them.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't make out where it was coming from. And then, during a blizzard, I went in there and to see if I could see where the snow was coming in. And what did I see? But very, very fine, dusty, powdery snow drifting in from goodness knows where. And when I looked to see where it was coming from, they were coming in through little old nail holes in the corrugated iron. And there were scores of these, of course.
Mm.
And so it seemed I didn't know how to stop the thing from getting filled up, you see. So I think I tried plugging it with paper and bits of cloth and stuff, but it was no good because the holes are too small.
Mm.
You hardly see them.
Mm.
And then I think I might have, I think I remember... baking up a bit of flour paste in the galley, and taking that out to paste them over. See, that would stop them, but I think the paste froze solid before you could use it, you see. So, anyway, I didn't carry on with that because it didn't work for some reason. So, when I was looking at these holes, you know, I sort of, out of disgust or desperation, I spat in them.
Mm.
And, of course, that froze them up, didn't it? And I thought it worked, you know. It stopped the holes.
Mm.
So I went round then, spitting at all these scores of little holes, wherever I could find one. And, you know, it stuck, and it stopped the trouble. And that's how we kept the snow out.
A lot less effort than the other methods.
Well, it did, and the others didn't work, you see.
Mm.
And, you know, spitting on them, because it froze immediately.
Mm.
And it worked very well. And anyway, I cleared the drifts out then, and we had no more trouble.
Mm.
Mind, we left in the next spring, and I never heard whether all that melted off and it had to be done all over again. I couldn't say. The following year, for the next crowd that came. Aye, so that's a tip for anybody who's has that trouble again.
Yeah. Could you describe a typical day's routine?
Oh, it was very varied. I think we used to turn out about 7 or something like that in the morning. I can't remember now for sure. And then we used to have tea over in the middle of the morning. And then we used to have dinner at about 12, it was dinner hour, and then we used to turn through again about 1 o'clock and carry on working till about 5 or 6, and then we had to have a good feed and a good meal. But talking about tea, being on the coast, we had to get glacier ice, you know, for our water. And there was, of course, a lot of glaciers calving all the time. And there was no problem to find that. But during the winter, you couldn't tell sometimes which is glacier ice and what is sea ice. And sometimes somebody'd make a mistake. And you get when it came to tea, you know, we'd all be sitting down smiling, the hot tea in front of us, and all of everybody's face and go, but it's serious and sour. Somebody got sea ice, you see. And nobody likes salty tea very much.
No, I bet.
No, so that fellow's name was Mud for the rest of the day. Well, anyway, for the routine, well, really, you think being down there, you'd be wondering what to do with yourself. But actually, there was more work than you could manage almost. You're working after supper at night, you still carry on with working on getting ready for expeditions, you know, for sledging trips and so on. And really, you're working from the time you turned up to the time you turned out to the time you turned in. And I remember when we left the expedition, when we were aboard the Ajax, Fitzroy in the Ajax, going home in 1946. Feeling very much at a loose end, you know, and being idle practically the first time in 2 years. And it felt very odd.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, yes. Very odd indeed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What kind of things did you have to do to prepare for a sledge trip? What was important?
Well, getting the sledges rigged up and getting them put together. And one of my jobs particularly was making up the rations. Chippy made some sledge boxes, and then we put the rations, daily rations, in these. Well, it meant weighing out, because Mar and Doc Back, they worked out the daily rations, what each man should have, you see, for health and to do the work. And of course, they would refer to literature, Scott's experience and so on. And we had about a pound and three quarters of food per man per day. And this was pemmican and biscuit, pea flour, dried milk, bit of sugar, bit of tea, cocoa, chocolate in 2 ounce bars. Butter and things like that, you see. Anyway, it meant weighing out daily wax, man wax, for perhaps a month or two, whatever it was, the length of the trip you're planning, you see, and putting them into little linen bags and to save the weight of the jars and the tins, you see. And also thought that we could get at them, because I mean, the tin, you lost the tin opening, where would you be? You'd be stuck, wouldn't you? And then the paraffin and all that. You mean, looking back on it now, we had linen bags, you see. Well, there's nothing to that, but somebody had to think about, foresee that, you see. Mar or whatever, you see. I know, it's marvellous. We lack for nothing. Little details like that, you see. This is one of the things, making up the rations and getting the paraffin, weighed out or ready for the trip. And that was for when we were man hauling. And of course, with the dogs, you had to get the dog rations as well. They had 2 pounds of pemmican a day. And I used to, in a way, feel a bit jealous of them, because they had 2 pounds and we had 1 3/4. But I thought, well, Duke, they're working a lot harder than we are. They deserve it. In fact, you know, you had to be strict with yourself, not to pinch some of their Pemmican and start knowing that, you see, there was little briquettes, because what I take, fair play, you know, pinching food like that. I know, I did take a nibble out, I did get a cake once, it's jolly good. I could have eaten a whole lot. But anyway, they deserved it more than I did. Oh, they were marvellous fellows, those dogs. Marvellous.
I bet you really appreciated them after a year without.
Well, after manhauling, you did. You respected them. Because you knew what it was, what they had to pull. And, I mean, I don't want to jump ahead too much, but it's not the same sledge dogs. It's missing. It's not like having pet dogs in this country. I mean, the point is, it's something like rather having like having a sheep dog. You respect the working dog. Because you're part of a team. And in fact, when the going was hard, we sometimes used to take a trace and pull along with the crowd, along with the dogs, you see. And they got great guts, and sometimes you'd be in a jam, like when we used to be falling through the ice, when the snow melted the top ice, the top snow on the sea ice one time, and, you know, we were falling through into the water, and... if the dogs hadn't kept going, we'd have been in right mess. And they kept going, they were very gutsy. And we were really dependent on them, really, that way, for our lives, I suppose. And I have tremendous respect for them. Anyway, you know, I'm going off at a tangent, so I don't want to.
Well, I'd like to talk to you about that later.
Yes, I'm sorry.
I understand you also had to do something for the sledge runners. You had to make something for them.
For the sledge runners?
Yes.
Well, all I remember doing is burning Stockholm tar into them, as we did on our skis, to make them run better.
Oh, I see.
Yes, yeah. you smear them with Stockholm tar and you melt it in with a blow lamp.
Yeah, awesome.
Well, that's all I remember doing with them.
Oh, and with the skis you had to make sort of little...
Oh, yes, well, of course, with the skis... we did that as well. None of us could ski, incidentally, when we got down there. And, you know, a crowd of sailors and amateurs we were, you see, and most of us never seen a ski. I don't think I ever had. And so we had to teach ourselves to ski, and we had great fun doing that. And when we used to knock off on Sunday afternoons, it was our free time, you see. And the first thing you had to learn was how to stop. All you had to do was sit down. That's amateurish, you know. It's laughable, really.
Was there anybody that was good on skis beforehand?
Well, Lamb, he'd been on skis, I think, in Finland. But he was the only man who'd ever been had his feet in them, as far as I know. Taylor, he'd worked with snowshoes in Canadian Arctic, but he'd never actually been on skis. But we got quite good at it. We used to go skiing up on the glacier, you see, on Sunday afternoon, and get practice. But this kind of thing really was pleasure skiing I'm talking about. Now, the real skiing that mattered was when we were man-hauling, or actually when we had the dogs skiing with the sledges. But when we were man-hauling, we needed to have skins on the skis to be able to get a grip on the snow. So what we did was to cut, when we got a Weddell seal, was to cut long strips of the skin off the seal and stitch it round the skis. And you had to make sure that when you did this, the fur was the all pointing, all running the fore and aft, you know, absolutely dead straight, right down the length of the ski, otherwise you'd go crooked. I remember very well cutting a length of strip. It was part of it went under the arm, under the flipper of the seal, you see, and with a little bit of a twiddle there in the fur. And I put it on the ski, thought it wouldn't matter, but by golly, I could hardly keep the ski in a straight course, you know, it was really troublesome. And so it was important to keep them straight. But once you got them on properly, you could go up a 45 degree slope in them, it was marvellous. And you could pull anything. And What amazed me was how strong the skin was. You put them on the end of the tips of the skis, you'd stitch them on, you see, stitch the ends together, make little pockets over the tips of the skis, and then this thing was lying like a great big sort of sausage underneath. And so what you did, you with a palm of needle, you stitched the edges over the top of the ski and pull really hard, like crisscross, you see, along the length. And, you know, if you put the needle in a half inch from the edge, you could pull as hard as you like, it'd never tear. Yeah. And it was marvellous. And in time, of course, the stuff would harden then.
Yeah.
And you'd, you know, they'd last for ages, for miles.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I suppose they have artificial skins now.
Yes, I'm afraid I don't know. It's something I've not thought about.
The only trouble with the skins was that really you couldn't get a very good grip on the side of the ski when you were going down a slope, traversing a slope. And they used to wear them out rather a lot too. But just, you know, see, the edge of the ski was rather rounded. And
yes, you didn't have that sharp edge to
the ski. No, I think they have edges called Bilgiri Hashtag things or whatever it is on skis. For that purpose, but that was the only disadvantage with them. But anyway, we didn't, as I say, we didn't do much of that sort of gallivanting about when we were sledging, because it was mainly a question of man hauling.
Yes. Yeah. Were your duties at Hope Bay much the same?
Whether they're the same as those at Port Lacroix? Well, much the same, as I said, but there were the dogs to feed, and as far as the duties about the base are concerned, and that's just a routine job, but as I say, that others also helped or did that work, like David James. He had a lot to do with the dogs, and Freddie Marshall brought them down. He was he taught us the, you know, the elements of what he'd been told by the Eskimos up in Labrador, where he went to fetch them.
So he knew how to drive them, did he?
I beg your pardon?
Did he know how to drive dogs?
Freddie Marshall?
Yeah.
Well, none of us did, really. I don't think he'd had any special experience except from what the Eskimos had told him. And so we went, we relied a lot, of course, on the experience of the Bridget Grahamland expedition, Rymel and Stevenson and company, of course, and their experience. And for that reason, we used the fan system of harnessing them, rather than the having them in between parallel traces. Various things like we relied a lot upon the BGLE experience, of course, and all the time over many things, rations and so on.
Yeah, you've had a report or something.
Oh yes. Well, personally, I didn't really know much about it, but I knew that that the others, the boss and others, were looking a lot at what they'd learnt about that sort of thing. I should say the duties very much the same, really, as general handyman. Of course, sledging trips were a bit more frequent and longer, but, you know, with the dogs, of course, you really did appreciate what the dogs were doing. Having been man hauling.
Yeah. What happened when a group of people went off sledging, and what did the people that were left behind do? Was it?
Well, there was a usual routine of keeping the hut going, and there was weather observations, a wireless routine. It's a funny thing, but although we were so busy, I can't remember all that clearly.
Long time ago.
Well, it is, you know, there's great blanks in my mind now, you see.
Would you describe the establishment of Hope Bay Base? Because it was quite a dramatic affair. Really.
Well, yes, I think this has been well described by David James and in That Frozen Land, the book he wrote, and by Vivian Fuchs, Sir Vivian, in that book, Of Ice and Men. I mean, I could repeat that, but I think they'd better tell that story.
Yeah.
All I remember is that we were called out as far as the Eagle was. Well, yeah, we were landed, you see. We had this Newfoundland sealer, the Eagle, that brought stores from for the next year for the expedition. And she was anchored in Hope Bay, and we landed most of the stuff from her. And a gale blew up, and an iceberg bore down upon her, and she was carried away a bowsprit and stove in her bows, and she was blown out to sea, and we never thought we'd see her again or hear her again. Mm. But luckily they made it to the Falklands.
Mm.
But I remember being all hands on deck, being called out in the middle of that gale, and running down to the shore with coils of rope and whatever else is necessary.
Because they at one point were thinking of beaching
her, that's right. Mm. But the Captain Shepherd, he decided to run for the Falklands.
Mm.
Mm. And we lost some of the gear, not lost it, but they had to take away some of the gear, which they failed to land, but nevertheless we had enough to get on with.
Mm.
He was a fiery, fine man, a very brave man. And he
Captain Shepherd.
Yes, he smashed himself up during that trip. Didn't, you know, got thrown about by the sea.
He
was a fine chap. What was that? Did that answer your question?
Yes. In fact, the fact that the ship had to leave left you quite a lot of work, didn't it, in transferring stores?
Oh yes, I suppose it did. I'd forgotten about that. Yes, we had to drag a lot of it ashore, across this bit of land to the hut, on sledges and so on.
And that gave you a bit of practice with the dogs, I suppose.
Well, it did, yes. I think David James and Freddie Marshall were more in charge of the dogs at that time. Mm. I think they had certainly did a lot of that work.
Mm.
But really, the dogs, I think the dogs taught us, because they'd been trained by the Eskimos, you see, and so long as we knew the orders, ill for left and yuk for right and ah for stop, and now, boys, wheat now, that is... when we want them to get up, you know, to start off, you know, to break the sledge out, things like that, and they knew what to do.
Yeah.
So they were our teachers.
Mm. Mm. Was it relatively easy to learn, did you find? Or?
Well, I suppose in a crude sort of way, it went okay, but I remember we had Eskimo whips, and they were great. Things with great long, flexible rawhide handles and great long leather whips, they were.
Mm.
And sometimes you'd. What we used to do was to make the dogs go to one way or the other, we used to lay the whip on the snow alongside them, you see, so that they'd shear away from it and go along with giving them the order to go left or right. And that used to help. But you had to be jolly careful how you handled that whip, because if you weren't very good at it, you'd get the end of it round your neck. And it was, you know, it'd give you a black eye.
Mm.
That thong coming along was about, I don't know how long, 10, 15, 20 feet long. So, in the end, I got wary of this. And I got a broom handle and put the whip on the end of that and held it out at arm's length before I did any of that sort of stunt, you know. Well, tear in my head. That worked okay.
That solved that problem.
And then, you know, and of course the Eskimos, they could use a whip precisely, and what we wanted to do was be able to give a flick to one or two of the dogs that was hanging back with a slack trace, you see, but you're more likely to copy yourself than the dog was. We were kind to the dogs, and we should have been for very... for very good reasons. We talk more about our own safety.
Were they real characters?
Oh, great Scott, yes. Oh, yes.
They were individuals.
Oh, yes, indeed. Just extra members of the expedition.
Mm.
I mean, being so few of you down there, of course, there were extra people. It's like that old pig we had, you know.
Mm.
I don't know if I mentioned him before. But,
this was at Port Lockroy.
Do you want me to say anything about the
pig? Yes, please.
It just shows, you know, how attached you can get to these things. Well, when we were relieved at the end of the first year, the Scoresby came down from the Falklands with just to see how we were. And they brought a little pig, two little pigs with them. And one is for deception and one is for us. And we were to fatten these up on our scraps and to enjoy a nice feed of pork. That was the idea.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much pork in the roof. Well, when this little fellow came ashore, that made our expedition one man extra, didn't it? Or one girl, actually, because he was a little sow. But when this little thing came ashore, the whole stack, as you know, was shivering. Couldn't have been sorry for it. You know? So, first thing to do was to make a hut for her. So I got an old crate and filled it with wood wool and blocked in two-thirds of the entrance, and the little pig dived in, and all you could see was a snout sticking out. And, you know, because it gave a kind of fellow feeling for the creature. What all we were concerned was keeping warm. And, you know, she kept that sty as clean as a whistle. Never fouled it. And it was my job really to look after the pig. And we used to give her scraps. I can't remember what. And put it out in a dish in front of the sty. And the old pig would come out. The only thing he would fetch her out. And, you know, in time the seagulls came to know that this feed was going there, and used to get these great big black-backed gulls and these little paddy birds, what do you call them, sheathbills, all crowding round. In fact, the gulls would even feed out of her hands by the end. They got that tame. But as soon as the old pig came along, of course, they'd scatter until they'd stand by respectfully until he'd had his feed, and then they'd come in and dive in and finish off what was left. So we'd kept this pig for about 3 or 4 weeks between the trips when the ships came down again, you see, to take us to Hope Bay. And, you know, he used to get very fond of this old pig. He used to play tip and run with her, you see. She'd run one way, and I'd chase her, and then I'd run away, and the old pig would chase me.
Oh,
you know. One time, Chippy had been painting one of the boats, painting her grey. And then we knocked off for dinner. The next thing, what did we see when we came out for dinner but an old grey pig coming up? You know, they like the pigs do, they like to saw their sides against anything like that. And she fairly coated herself with grey paint. We had a bit of a job to get that off her. In the end, got them all up.
I suppose, unfortunately, she'd been brought down to supplement your diet.
Well, that's it, you see. Well, the dogs were coming, and we knew that there was no place for dogs and a pig. Because what happened in Deception was that, we found out later, was that when the dogs were landed, they got at the pig, and the pig just disappeared. Just scattered all over the beach, you know, just arms and legs and bones and things. Terrible. So we realised that we couldn't keep the pig. As a member of the expedition, so we had to kill it. And there's a bit of a quandary that, because I hated to break trust, you see. And so perhaps it was cheating, but the only way I could think of doing it in the best way, I waited till the pig was asleep in the sun, snoozing away, and I got a 4.5 revolver and, you know, shot a point blank right in the head, and finished her like that, you see, and she never knew a thing. But, you know, we were broken hearted. And none of us really enjoyed that.
No.
But being okay, you know, what could you do?
That's right. Yeah. And the people at Stanley only thought they were being helpful.
Oh, yes, I mean, they didn't think nothing of it, and they were. It was all in good faith. And I suppose a bit sentimental, I suppose, but you get attached, you see, because. You know, we were the only living creatures there within hundreds and thousands, hundreds of miles. And we used to get very attached to the birds, you see. And I suppose if a blue bottle had come down there, we'd have made friends with that too. You know, it's like being in outer space in a way. Very much that feeling, being on the edge of the living world.
Did you in fact find that the same individual birds would hang around the base, that you got to know individuals?
Well, I don't remember knowing any of them by name or by, you know, individually, except that they'd be the same type of bird there day after day, so you guessed probably were the same ones. I don't know whether we upset the migration routine of the paddies or not, because they're stuck there all the winter with the scraps we used to give them to eat. They were comical things too.
If we could talk for a little while about the field trips that you went on.
Yes.
The first major one that you took part in was the surveying trip on Vinke Island.
That's right.
Yeah. Could you tell me something about that? If we start off generally.
Well, yes. We got up the glacier, you know, with the help of...
You were manhauling,
weren't you? Manhauling, that's right. There were four of us. There were James Marr and myself had one sledge, and the other sledge was pulled by Lamb and Taylor. Mm-hmm. And so we set off, and Doc and Fram, I think, Farrington, helped us up the first bit. Mm. Or Johnny Blythe, I can't remember who came with us. Anyway, you know, two or three of us helping us to get us off and up the steepest part of the glacier. Mm-hmm. And so we set off for the other side of Vinke Island. There's a great big pass between two high mountains, Mount Luigi de Savoia, I think, was one of them. It was about 4,000 feet high. Mm. And there was some big mountain, I forget the name, on the other side, about 3,000 or so. And there were like sheer cliffs, really, almost coming down to the glacier. And we had to watch out for the ice falls coming down these. And going through that pass, you know, it seemed absolutely minute, like little bugs almost, you know, crawling up the glacier. These mountains are so huge.
Yes, towering over.
Yeah. Mm. And I remember we were harnessed to the sledge, you see, in case... Well, it's only natural, of course. And I remember we must have gone too close to one side or other, because we heard a bit of a rumble. The next thing we saw was an ice fall coming down the cliff. Mm. And so, of course, our instinct was to dash off, you see, get clear of it. And we were brought up sharp by the sledges. We couldn't get out of them, and our fingers were too frozen to let go. So, instinctively, I think we just lay down on the snow and had to see, as it were, as you might in a small boat, you see. Mm. Anyway, luckily nothing happened. We've got a terrific blast of ice dust came at us, but nothing big. Mm. And it had just stopped short of us, this avalanche, and so we were very thankful, and so we made out to the middle of the glacier after that and kept well clear right in the middle. So, and after that we got over the other side, and we surveyed. We had about a month or so on that trip. We were weatherbound for must have been half the time. And
what was that like? Did you just feel frustrated, or did you quite enjoy it?
It made you think about your food all the time, really, having nothing to do.
Mm.
And we couldn't do anything about it because we hadn't got we're on our rations. But there's one funny thing that happened through lying in the same place all the time when we were weatherbound. It wasn't cold, it wasn't desperately cold, it was perhaps 20 degrees or so below freezing Fahrenheit, minus a temperature of about, say, 15 to 20 Fahrenheit, with freezing at 32. And so it wasn't cold, and what happened was that when we were lying on our sleeping bags, we made a kind of a hollow in the snow with the warmth of our bodies, and although we had a deer skin and some canvas ground sheet, of course, and a deer skin and double sleeping bags, it still, as it were, melted the snow a bit. But the worst of it was that the snow was underneath the waterproof ground sheet. That was okay. But the worst of it was that the condensation from our bodies also condensed, and that gathered in pools underneath the sleeping bags, and till they were quite sopping, and you had to wring them out. And it was a bit uncomfortable. If it had been If it had been a bit drier, colder, it would have been all right. Mm. But after that experience, I experimented when we got back to base with sleeping out in the Nissen hut with on a kind of a hammock with the part of the sleeping bag underneath, like a hammock inside a sleeping bag, to see if the insulation would be kept so it's not being compressed, you see. Mm. And I think that worked quite well. There was no sign of any damp forming then. But how you'd work that out in a tent, I really didn't. I didn't figure out.
Mm. I had various ideas.
Well, yes, it would mean having a kind of a camp bed slung on the poles of the of the tent. And I don't really think, looking back, that this was a very common problem. I think it was rather a specialised problem, and most times people have to put up in much colder weather where that problem doesn't arise. So
You did a bit more experimenting, in fact, didn't you? You had a go in an igloo.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Well, Lamb made an igloo. We had a Polar Record which described how to make an Eskimo igloo, and he made a very fine igloo about, 5 or 6 feet high, proper thing. And I made various igloos too, but smaller things, you know, half sunk. And we spent a night, at least I spent a night in one of these igloos with a little candle, and it was quite cosy, quite warm. And not a breath of wind, you see. Oh yes, it was very comfortable indeed.
And how long did it take to build?
Oh, it took him quite a while because he made a proper one. He must have the best part of the day. The ones I made, it didn't take so long because I used to dig out half the base, you see, and just cover the upper half with snow blocks, and so that was it was some idea I had of making emergency igloos, you know, if you were stuck without a tent. I remember one time we were on the glacier. It was a Sunday afternoon, and Lam and I had gone up there to do some skiing. It was in our free time, you see. So I thought I'd practice making one of these igloos. And I'd got a shovel with me, and I chose a nice, smooth, level bit of glacier. And I started digging out the circle, you see, 6 foot diameter of the igloo, and I got one spit down and chucked that out, and then I started digging out the next spit, and it was hard snow, and you had to punch really hard with the round nose shovel. The next thing I knew, my shovel went right up to its handle. What was this fool doing but digging himself through a snow bridge? I could see a great big blue black gaping hole underneath, and a cold breeze coming up. So you never saw anybody jump out of bridge. And Lamb saw a white-faced figure stacking towards him. So the point was, you see, this is winter time. The point was that you can't tell that these crevasses are underneath you. And in the summer when the snow melted a bit, I could see where the crevasse was. You could see the furrow in the snow. So I thought, well, you could think twice really before you start digging your glues in a glacier.
Yes.
At least have a rope tied to a peg anyway.
A bit close.
Taught me a lesson.
Nobody on the expedition actually fell down a crevasse, did they?
No, fortunately not. No, I mean, I've been reading of Ice and Men, that book, and the terrible experiences that some of them had. No, we were spared that. Oh, when we were setting off, actually, on this Spinky Island trip, all that happened was that the sledge went capsized, breaking through a snow bridge. But we soon got it out. It was a very narrow crevasse, and that was the only trouble we had. On this trip, I'd just like to recall something which showed something about Mar. We were, chaining a distance on Winky Island, on the far side, to get sights, I suppose, on the distant peaks. Because Taylor was a surveyor, and Mar and I were chaining, and Taylor and Lamb were doing the survey work, the survey work. And it meant pulling out this chain, I don't know how long it is, and then putting in a little mark a flag, and then Mar would come up to it. And then I'd go ahead and put in another marker flag into that straight line and so on. And we've been doing this a while. And all of a sudden, there was no marker flag. And I'd forgotten to put one in. Cool, gracious me. And you know, I thought, hey, oh, we could perhaps guess where it was, you know. No. It was not good enough. We had to go back to the very beginning again, do the whole thing, and we were cold and hungry as we were getting towards the end of it. The whole thing over again. And didn't I feel a fool, you know? I mean, he was absolutely dead right. He was absolutely dead right. He didn't say much. He said, no, so we've got to do it again. But it just shows how thorough he was.
Yes.
Conscientious. I mean, he was absolutely right. It was
that's it.
A big, unforgivable thing to do on my part.
The trouble is, it's so easily done.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Absent-minded, you see. And another time, too, we were in the tent and the primus wasn't working very well. One of the Aurora primuses. And so I thought I'd change the nipple, you see. And it was one of these double-jointed things. And when I came to unscrew it, what with the stiffness of the joints, the nipple must have been too tight, because I sheared it off. Well, that was trouble. That was trouble. We got no way of cooking off wood. I know Taylor and Nan were in the next tent, but I mean, in a gale of wind, you didn't feel like dumping over there. Well, Ma didn't say anything. He just got hold of a bit of a nail, and he filed it down. And he jammed it in this hole and he got that primus to work. It was rather a smoky and feeble kind of jet, but it did cook, you know. Very resourceful.
Yes.
Very patient.
Yes, that's one of the things that really comes over, this immense store of just dogged patience.
Yeah.
And,
very forbearing.
So he made a good leader then.
Oh, great Scott, yes. Oh, great Scott, yes. Yes, I have a lot to learn from him. I mean, that's just a little thing. I mean, there's 1,001 other ways in which this showed too. I mean, whenever there was a miserable job to do, for instance, something, one of the windows blew in or something during a blizzard, he was the first man out, tacking up concrete, tacking up, you know, canvas, and all that sort of thing with his cold hands. And if ever there was a miserable, horrible job, or a dangerous job, he was there in the thick of this. Jock Matheson used to say that, you know, he was a good man to have aloft with you, taking in sail. Like, well, imagine it.
Yes, they'd served together, haven't they?
Yes, in the Discovery, the old Discovery, in the bark. Oh, yes. Yeah, very few people. And, you know, he had great influence on me in that way, because the way he used to drive himself, never lay back, he said, never lay back. And you felt really that, what do you call it? It wasn't the thing to do, to take things easy. You've got to, you know, do a proper job and to do it to your utmost for the rest of your life, really. As far as you could. Not lay back and take it easy.
Yes, you'd always got his example.
That's right, there's an example. Yeah. Oh, I never forget an example like that. I indeed.
It's very nice to have served with someone like that.
Well, it's a great education. Yeah. Great education.
He was a bit of a humorist as well.
Humorist, oh, he was. He got some funny sayings and little chants and I don't know what you call them, expressions, I suppose. And he was always kind of coming out with these, just like a bird would, you know, like a penguin almost, and chanting away. And we all used to have a quiet smile on the side. But he used to do this, you know, quite without thinking and talking to himself as much as anything. And You know, when we meet now, we often think of Mar's sayings and how we used to have a good laugh at them. It was typical of him. I don't know where he got them from. I never heard them when I was at sea. Mm. I think he must have picked them up in this course of his scientific work in Discovery, or is it some of them semi-scientific?
Mm. Was there, in fact, anyone on the expedition who was the practical joker, or did you not have someone like that?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say a practical joker. He put on, I remember one turn, he used to have us in fits, you know. He was very solemn about it all, but he had a great sense of humour.
Mm.
In that way, but normally he wasn't a smiling sort of person at all. I think he was naturally a bit dour, but apart from that, I think just the sheer anxieties of what he had to do, and the whole expedition, and the strain of getting it up, and things didn't go right, you know, the expedition ship had to be abandoned, and we couldn't land on the mainland the first year, and all that sort of thing, you know. I think it told on him.
Mm. He probably took it quite personally.
I don't know. I couldn't really say about that, but he felt it was his duty to do this, and I don't know whether I think he prayed in his mind a bit, that sort of thing. But he was. He had a lot in his mind, you know, and I wish that. I realised this a bit more at the time, really.
Did he have a deputy as such, or was...
Pardon?
Did he have a deputy? I don't know, a deputy leader?
Well, yes, Taylor, he was, I think, a deputy, and he took charge when Mar had to go back in Hope Bay when he hurt his back. Mm. He certainly pitched into the leadership of the Hope Bay landing.
Mm. But he didn't really have someone to support him while he was there?
Well, I suppose that he would have had the older people. I mean, Lamb and Taylor and people like that, you know?
Mm.
Oh, yes.
Mm.
Yes.
Mm.
Yes. Mind, I knew nothing, very little about this sort of thing, you see, because, I mean, if they had a quiet word together, I wouldn't have been around. I'd have been outside somewhere.
Mm.
I really wouldn't know much about it.
Mm.
Perhaps Doc Pack could tell you, and Fran could tell you something about that.
Mm.
I was more outside than anywhere else, you see, so I didn't really see a lot of what was going on in the hut. But Mar was very much an outside man too.
Would you like to stop for a little while?
Well, if you like, yes. I'm sure I've been talking far too much.
Well, not at all.
And,
If we could discuss your second trip now around James Ross Island Hope Bay. You used dogs on that occasion, of course.
Oh, yes.
Could you tell me how you found that difference from man-hauling?
Oh, it was great.
Mm.
Oh, yes, they did the work.
Mm.
And all we had to do was to ski along beside the sledge and just keep them on a straight course. Of course, as I said, I think I said about described earlier how we used to have to help them at times when the going was rough and sled was capsized and that sort of thing, but that was nothing compared to what they were doing for us.
Was man hauling very heavy work?
Yes, it was. It was quite hard going, really. I don't know what we had. Perhaps 100 weight each to haul or something like that. I think Scott and his party, they had the terrible old job pulling your sledges right up to the pole.
How did you navigate?
Well, most of the time you could really see ahead, you know, to some mountain peak or some landmark or other when we were navigating, but I remember one time we had to cross a 10-mile ice field or glacier to get from the Bay of 1,000 Icebergs back to the base, and it came on thick, you see, and we couldn't see at all, so We had a compass then, and we had the two dog teams, and we pointed them up the glacier in the right direction, and set off according to the compass bearing. And when the sledge went off course, we just threw the whip along one side or the other with our orders, and the dogs would come onto course again. Mm. And, you know, there was a compass waving about. We managed to keep a course. And I was never so surprised to find that at the end of the trip, we actually landed where we should have landed. I was astonished because the compass was all over the shop.
Mm.
And it was important to keep on course because, of course, there were ice cliffs too, part of the edge. And it really gave me faith in that method of navigation.
Mm. What were your maps like? Were they detailed or rather sketchy?
Well, they were sketchy. Norton Schold had made some sort of a map, hadn't he? And we had some kind of previous charts from the Admiralty, but they were pretty sketchy. I'm not really the best one to ask about that, because people like Taylor and Dave James and, they had more to do with that side of it.
Mm.
And so you better ask them.
Mm.
Mm. Aye.
Mm. What do you remember particularly about that second trip? Because it was probably your longest.
It was the longest. Mm. Well, I think one of the things I remember is that eerie feeling of going onto places where no man had ever trodden before since the earth was made. That was one thing. It was quite eerie, you know. And not only that, but the scenery itself was very grim. It was very majestic and very grim. It just was, you know, a brooding kind of threat behind you all the time, what with that and the weather. And it made you feel you're very much out of place in a place like that. I remember listening to one of the American astronauts talking either during his trip or after his trip about looking back on Mother Earth below and what a warm and lovely place it looked from out there, you know. And I felt what he, I mean, this is just what I used to feel out sledging, really. We were miles from anywhere and out of the living world. And we felt that where we were was only the edge of a much vaster region stretching from the Antarctic right to the back of beyond the furthest stars, really. It was a hostile world. And I really thought of that rang a bell, really, what that astronaut said, in a way.
Mm.
And there's another time, you know, when we were very much at the mercy of the elements, and we used to be keeping a sharp lookout at the sky to see what the weather was going to do, and particularly if there were any blizzards blowing up. And as soon as we saw the mare's tails coming up from the south or southwest, we used to know that we'd have to find a camping site pretty soon and put the tent up as soon as we could before the wind hit us. And I often used to think of those mare's tails as sledges, you know, as sledges of the blizzard. And I used to imagine the demon of the wind flogging his team of dogs across the sky, you know, like some terrible fiend, until it burst on us with a roar and a shriek, and we'd have to get our heads down.
Mm. So you usually found you had a bit of warning before a blizzard was coming?
Well, occasionally you did sometimes, yes.
Mm. Mm.
You had to take heed and know what to expect.
Mm.
I think I'd... But it was an earthly kind of place, really, and you never forget it. It was beautiful in its grim way. I remember when I came back to this country and saw this country in the fields and the hedges, they looked like a lot of, very piffling, like a glorified allotment. And you miss that kind of grandeur. And I went to Sweden after, and it was a bit better there because the land was more open, it was simpler, the scenery, the open farmlands and the vast blocks of wild forest and the Great Lakes, and that was a bit more akin to the Antarctic scenery in its way. But this is something I used to miss, as the grandeur of it. It gets into you, you see. And it's like when you look at the night sky and you begin to wonder what's up there, and you take your mind outside this little earth, doesn't it? You never forget it, and you can't. You know, it gives you a different outlook somehow on the problems of the world's peoples. The world is one, and we used to think, what a lovely place is this earth, you know, down in the temperate zones, in the tropics. It's food, it's warmth, and rain, and things will grow there. It's not a place of death. And my feeling was then, well, why on earth can't we make the best of it and run the earth like an expedition, and so that, make the, you know, whack out what there is between all hands, as it were, you know? I didn't see the sense in all this terrible quarrelling that was going on at all, you know. I thought a trip in Hope Bay would have done the United Nations a lot of good.
Probably got something there. Could you tell me about the sledging routine? Did you work having an inside man and an outside man when you go to camp or made camp, for instance?
Oh yes, we used to have a turn and turn about. Oh yes.
And what did each person have to do?
Well, say the two of you. Well, once we got the tent up, which is a job for. Oh, just a minute. No. First of all, we'd stop at the where we were going to camp, and then next thing we'd stretch out the dog lines, a wire rope with lines, you know, chains strung along it for the dogs, and we'd make jolly sure that they were stretching out well apart too, so the dogs wouldn't get at each other. And then, having tethered the dogs, we'd feed them then. I can't remember the exact order, but that was one of the things that we had to do pretty promptly, and even see to them as soon as we could. And then we'd put up the tent together. I think probably that was one of the first things, and then we'd tether the dogs after. I can't remember, I got muddled. And while one man was getting snow in and getting the primus going, the other man would be perhaps feeding the dogs and ashing the getting the gear out of sleeping bags and things off the sledge, and doing what was necessary that way. I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact details of the routine.
No.
You see,
doesn't
but that was the sort of thing. Anyway, by the time the outside man had finished, he'd hoped that there was something brewing inside the tent, a cup of tea or something of the sort. Anyway, start us off, because you just had your whack, and after you'd had your 1¾ pounds, that was it, wasn't it? But by golly, we did enjoy that too. They talk about pemmican. Some people talk about pemmican with a bit of a sneer, but we couldn't get enough of it. It was marvellous. It was great. You know, you're hungry.
And did you find it was sustaining enough?
Yes, it was half fat and half oxo or beef flavour or something, but anyway, it was great stuff. What do you see, we were better off on the sea ice, because now and again we'd come across a seal, and we'd cut that up. We'd kill that and cut it up for the dogs and ourselves. The dogs would get 14 parts for the 14 dogs, and we get the head. And then we'd make our stew, our usual stew of pemmican and water and a bit of pea flour in it. And then what we'd do, we'd get the break open the head, the skull, and get the brains out and stew them too. Or else we'd get some of the meat and chop it up with little bits and stew that for about 20 minutes. Well, you never had such a feed in your life. You see, it'd fill us up then. But the trouble with the rations were, I mean, they were enough. There were thousands of calories in it, I suppose. But you used to go through you like a dose of salt. And I don't know what it was, the matter, whether there wasn't enough fibre or too much fat or what it was, but that used to cause a bit of a problem.
I bet it did.
Yeah. But you never used to feel full, but we were never starving. Never starving. Not on those rations, as long as the rations lasted. You were always hungry. And sometimes, you know, when you used to come across a seal meat, well, that was a great thing that you remember, the great feeds you used to have. And I think I've mentioned somewhere else the way how Vic Russell and I came across a penguin rookery once, right in the middle of nowhere, right in the middle of the sea ice. It was a little outcrop of rock, and we happened to come across them in the nesting season. And there were plenty of eggs, and so we gathered about 3 dozen eggs, and for that that night's supper and the next morning's breakfast, we ate 18 eggs each, and the size of goose's eggs, weren't they?
Good gracious.
You never had such a feed in your life.
And do they taste very like a hen's egg? Or
well, I suppose they were. Because we were more used to dried eggs, weren't we? At that time. And oh yes, they were marvellous things. And what we used to do is to break half a dozen of them into a mug and stir it up with a bit of powdered milk and a bit of sugar, you see, and then put boiling water on that, and then for a treat, and this was a special emergency, we used to put a teaspoonful of brandy, emergency brandy. My word, you never had such a feed in your life. And of course, if you'd had a mug of that, well, you know, you wouldn't want anything else. And that's how we managed to put down so many of them. And then we had scrambled eggs, you see, great feeds. But yeah, you know, it sounds greedy talking, I guess, about food, but you're that hungry, you know, you thought about little else.
Were there any particular high points to life on base, such as Midwinter's Day?
Well, yes, Midwinter's Day, and of course the time when we had the ship coming in with mail at the end of the year. That's when the post office got going, as it were. I think, well, Midwinter's Day, we just celebrated it to celebrate